Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Edith Harold, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this FedSoc Forum called Antitrust in the College Sports Arena. We'd like to welcome our excellent panelists today, Professor Jody Balsam, Eric Clark, and Rakesh Kilaroo, to this discussion. And we're very thankful to Caitlin Berry for moderating the conversation. Caitlin is an associate at Baker McKenzie. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. And near the end of the program, we may turn to the audience for questions. So if you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers and not the Federalist Society. With that, Caitlin, thanks so much for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
Thank you so much, Edith, and thank you to the Federalist Society, as well as the Corporation Securities and Antitrust Practice Group at the Federalist Society for putting on this event. So to just go over very quickly the wonderful bios of our panelists, we're going to start with Professor Balsam, who is a professor at Brooklyn Law School, and she's also a nationally recognized sport law expert. She teaches at law schools and master's programs around the world. And her publications and presentations have addressed antitrust challenges to sports leagues and organizing bodies, sports trademarks, NIL, exploitation, and all sorts of other exciting topics. Before joining academia, Professor Balsam was the NFL's Counsel for Operations and Litigation. And prior to that, she was at Simpson Thatcher and clerked for Judge Dennis Jacobs of the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, and Judge Bryant in the Southern District of New York. She went to Yale and received her law degree from NYU. And then we have Eric Clark. Eric Clark is the Deputy Attorney General for Major Litigation at the Ohio Attorney General's Office. He oversees major litigation in the office, and he also personally appears in court on behalf of the state of Ohio and advises the Attorney General on critical matters, including, of course, antitrust issues. He graduated summa cum laude from the Ohio State University School of Law and was editor-in-chief of their law review. After that, he clerked for Judge Sutton and then was at a law firm before joining the Ohio Attorney General's office. And last but not least, we have Rakesh Kilaroo, who is a partner at Wilkinson Stetkloff. And for the past couple of years, he has been a total rock star in the antitrust space, successfully resolving some of the biggest antitrust matters in history, including obtaining a full judgment for the NFL in the post-trial proceedings in a $21 billion challenge to the NFL's media model, negotiating a breakthrough innovative settlement. And he's also been heavily involved in the NCAA's compensation rules. Before that, he clerked for Justice Kagan and Judge Wilkinson. And then prior to that, obviously, he graduated from Stanford Law School. So please join me in welcoming our amazing panelists. And I will hand it over to them to discuss our opening statements.
So I guess I'll get started. But first of all, thanks, everyone, for having me here today. It's really great to get a chance to talk to all of you. Probably the biggest news in college sports antitrust right now surrounds the House antitrust settlement, which I figured I could start by giving a little bit of an overview of. So essentially for the last 15 to 20 plus years, the NCAA has faced antitrust litigation over rules regarding student athlete compensation. And those cases have, you know, come through a number of different paths. They've come through a case called O'Bannon. They then came through a case called Alston, which went up to the Supreme Court. And most recently, they involved a case called House versus NCAA. And the common theme of these cases is student athletes in a variety of different sports claiming that the NCAA's rules defining how much compensation student athletes can receive are antitrust violations because they're essentially horizontal agreements among schools to limit the price or limit the amount of money that can be provided to student athletes. So as I mentioned, those cases have been litigated for a very long time. They were litigated to judgment in the O'Bannon case in front of Judge Wilkin in the early 2010s. Another version of the case was litigated to judgment in front of Judge Wilkin again in about 2015, 2016. And that case ended up going up to the Supreme Court, which issued a decision that essentially said that NCAA rules are subject to the rule of reason under the antitrust laws as a general matter, which means that the NCAA doesn't get some kind of free pass or quick scrutiny for all of its rules, but that it needs to show why those rules are justified as an antitrust matter, particularly as regards to compensation. So against all the backdrop of that, a different group of student athletes filed a new lawsuit saying that the restrictions on NIL compensation, both from third parties, so from sponsors, from shoe companies, what have you, and then also directly from schools, were themselves a new form of antitrust violation. And we litigated that case for quite some time. I think the case was filed in 2019, if I remember correctly. But about 2 years ago or so, we started on behalf of the NCAA and the five major conferences, the SEC, the Pac-12, the ACC, Atlantic Coast Conference, the Big Ten, and the Big 12, all started negotiating a potential settlement with the plaintiff's attorneys in-house to see if, instead of continuing to litigate one case after another, we could forge some kind of peace from antitrust litigation. And out of those discussions came a settlement agreement, which was just finally approved by Judge Wilkin a couple weeks ago, about a week ago from last Friday. And essentially, the settlement has two big components. The first component is that looking backwards, so for the last 9 years of, or 8 years, I should say, of college sports, there have been these restrictions in place on how much compensation students can get directly from schools or from third parties. And there's a damages settlement that's designed to essentially provide recovery for those alleged economic and antitrust injuries. And that damage settlement amount was $2.8 billion, which compared to, I think, double-digit billions of exposure for the NCAA and the conferences if we continue to litigate. But that settlement is essentially going to go into a fund over the next 10 years, and it'll pay that group of student athletes in essentially incremental payments for a 10-year period to try to resolve any and all damages claims arising out of compensation limits. And then the second piece, which my guess is we'll spend a little more time talking about today, is a forward-looking injunction. So for the next 10 years, we've essentially agreed on a new structure through which to provide benefits to student athletes. We've negotiated something called a pool, which is essentially a form of revenue sharing, where the schools in Division I, some required, some optional, will have the ability to share up to 22% of a defined set of athletic department revenues directly with student athletes. And schools will have discretion in terms of how they want to provide those benefits, if they want to provide those benefits. And I think what we'll see are kind of new and different forms of competition among schools to compensate student athletes. So some schools may prioritize trying to have a really good football team. Some schools may prioritize trying to have a basketball team. Some sports schools may decide that they want to continue to have a broad base of athletic offerings. It's, you know, really will be up to the schools to decide. The settlement also gets rid of these things called scholarship limits, which were limits on the number of student athletes who could receive scholarship aid at a school. So more students can get benefits from their schools directly. And in exchange for all of this, the antitrust lawsuits for the next 10 years brought by student athletes are essentially released through an ongoing 10-year injunction. So every year, students who are coming into college sports for the first time will have an opportunity to object, raise concerns that they may have with the structure, say that things could be working better. Our hope is that that won't happen because we think the structure is going to work pretty well. But the idea is that for the next 10 years, this system will be in place where there will be some form of revenue sharing, some form of additional scholarships, and schools having a lot more freedom and discretion as to how to provide additional benefits to student athletes. So we're very much in the early days of the settlement process. We just got approval a couple of weeks ago. the settlement. Some features are going live already, which are reporting of existing NIL contracts that students have with sponsors. So pretty much any contract a student has with a sponsor, a shoe company, a local car dealership, what have you, that's over $600 will go into this reporting system. That's already up and operational. The pool itself will be effective and operational on July 1st. That's the first day of the settlement term. And we'll have, you know, a number of years to sort of potentially work out some kinks, but hopefully usher in a pretty new era of stability for the NCAA and for the conferences and for the schools, and also increased benefits for student athletes. So for those of us who are involved in the process, we're pretty excited about where we are. There's a lot of work to continue to do. That's a little bit of an overview of where we are in the settlement right now.
Thanks so much, Rakesh. And then I think next we're going to turn to Eric.
Good afternoon. Thanks so much, Caitlin. I was joking when we talked earlier this week that we have Professor Balsam and Rakesh here, and they know a heck of a lot about sports law and antitrust. And I have also practiced antitrust every once in a while. I believe that I am here to provide the elite athlete point of view, except that I never made any teams. So that's probably not it either. My experience in this area is, I think, largely centered upon a case that the Ohio Attorney General led a group of states, and the DOJ actually joined that group of states in challenging the eligibility to compete after a transfer. So as some people may know, during COVID, there was a new, so the rule already existed that if a student athlete transferred, they couldn't play for 1 year unless there were certain exceptions for that. During COVID, there was a, you know, blanket 1 year exception or one time transfer exception that became the transfer portal that we all know if you're a sports fan. And our case challenged the fact that it was limited to one time exception, because under the theory by which that Rakesh was just explaining, that was just as much an unreasonable restraint as anything else. And we were able to, we got an injunction in that case and ultimately came to an agreement with the NCAA about how to resolve that. That's how I got into this. I oversee the antitrust section in the Ohio Attorney General's office. And I think, you know, what I can contribute to this, at least the introductory comments, is sort of the interest of a state antitrust regulator in this entire situation. Antitrust lends itself well to consistent laws and rules and settlements that might handle, you know, every college in the nation. But there is a role for state antitrust law and separate state antitrust enforcement. As we all know, sometimes different states and the federal government have different priorities. And so by making sure that the states have a role, all priorities can be represented at least somewhere. And the states can, in fact, join forces, as they often do in multi-state actions, to take on antitrust issues that are affecting them locally or that are a nationwide problem that the states are able to work with the DOJ to help address. And the House settlement is pretty interesting because it calls for a, you know, essentially immunity, as Rakesh was saying, from antitrust suits. Now that's from private antitrust suits. The regulators, as I understand it, are not mentioned. I don't know if they even could be if they wanted to. I won't try to, you know, bind Rakesh to any particular position. But certainly, you know, standing here as someone who's, you know, handling state antitrust regulation, it's not that we definitely want to still be able to bring actions that would, you know, alleged violations of antitrust law, either state or federal, that would be in compliance with the House settlement. It may very well be the opposite, that, you know, it's best, it's in the best interest of everyone to allow that settlement to take place. But it is something that, you know, is important to think about because, sometimes the laws are different. We have a specific difference in Ohio's antitrust law as compared to the federal law that is really useful in dealing with like bid rigging and specifically going against the public officials who may be involved in bid rigging. And there's an argument as to whether the federal law covers that or not, but the Ohio law expressly covers it. And so those kind of things, if applied to this area, could be important. And so we don't want to throw a wrench into a really, you know, good settlement. But we also want to preserve, you know, the ability of the state government to make sure that everything works the way it's supposed to work. And to the extent there is some concern, and again, I'm not staying in Ohio, we have any, that we can still proceed with enforcing antitrust laws the way the attorney general and the people want us to. I think that's enough, right? Was that about 5 minutes?
I think that's probably good. Okay. And we're going to turn it. Oh, thank you, Eric. And we're going to turn it over to Professor Balsam.
Hi, everyone. And thanks for hosting us today. So I've been tasked with the role of describing what happens after the truce, right? Litigation peace has been purchased, but at what cost and how much litigation peace? And I think that it's naive to think there's been any real final judgment as to the future of college sports by virtue of the House settlement. As a former antitrust litigator myself, I totally appreciate why it was in all the parties' interest to enter this settlement. But what are they getting for their billions of dollars? They're not escaping future litigation threat, although it may not come from antitrust quarters. For example, just let's start with the terms of the settlement itself. Somebody has already mentioned in the Q&A that there are due process concerns that future athletes, today's 12-year-old basketball phenom, was not part of the class that was notified of the settlement or had an opportunity to object or opt out. And that athlete, say, six years from now, when they are recruited and matriculate at a D1 school, are potentially going to be bound by a settlement where they had no participation in the litigation or negotiation stage. Well, the settlement actually attempts to avoid these due process concerns by giving the choice to future college athletes upon matriculation whether or not to be bound by the settlement. So a future athlete could refuse to forego their share of the settlement fund and bring their own lawsuits, potentially. They don't have to, the hope is that it will be perceived as in their best interest and who wants to spend one's college years in court. But, and Rakesh, correct me if I'm wrong, if you were not notified of the settlement, if you are, you know, today 9 years old and never anticipated becoming an elite athlete recruited by a D1 school, you would still have a choice upon matriculation whether or not to be bound by the settlement. But the likelihood is that almost every athlete who enters into college sports at that level will accept the settlement terms. I think I might be having internet problems. I just want to make sure I'm still audible.
Yeah. We can see you and hear you clearly.
Yeah, great. So another major issue, which the House settlement has already experienced, is the question of Title IX's application, right? So the House settlement allows but does not require colleges to share revenue with athletes. For example, the Ivy League has announced it's not opting in and it's going to continue to treat its athletes as amateurs. The other schools, if they choose to engage in this revenue sharing, as Rakesh described, they're subject to a cap, not a floor. I believe the cap is 22% of the Power Five's average athletic revenues each year for the next 10 years, which is expected to be $20.5 million per school in 2025. So what do you do with that money? If they share, how are they going to share it? Who are they going to divvy it up amongst? it's anticipated that schools will allocate most of the funds to the revenue producing teams like football and men's basketball. But how do you factor in the risk of that, this disproportionate compensation of men over women athletes might run afoul of Title IX? Right, so Title IX says no person shall be on the basis of sex discriminated against in any educational program that receives federal funds. And that's been interpreted to require that total dollars of athletic financial assistance allocated to each sex is proportionate to the percentage of athletes of each sex at that institution. So the big question is, are the house settlement distributions a form of athletic financial assistance within the meaning of Title IX? Does that $20.5 million per institution have to be allocated proportionate to male and female athletes on campus? And right now, it's anticipated for most schools, about 90% of those funds will wind up in the pockets of male athletes. And we already have one appeal of the House settlement based on this calculation. There is one pending appeal of the settlement by objectors who were not satisfied with the final negotiated agreement. They're appealing principally on the basis that Title IX requires that the settlement dollars be allocated proportionate to the number of female and male athletes on campus, which is not 90 to 10%. It's more like 50-50. For a lot of schools, or maybe at most best 60-40. But here's the rub. Does that revenue sharing pool, is it subject to Title IX? And there are different tests for Title IX compliance. And the schools might argue that revenue sharing of NIL revenues is based on the use of the athlete's right of publicity, which is ordinarily tied to an athlete's unique identity and thus outside the scope of Title IX. That Title IX does not require proportionate or equitable sharing of monies that are generated by virtue of an individual athlete's appeal, their NIL appeal. And right now, the current Department of Justice would seem to support that viewpoint. Don't expect, at least in the next 4 years, the current DOJ or Department of Education to challenge disproportionate revenue sharing with under a Title IX theory. There was a fact sheet issued by the Biden administration just before the Trump inauguration that NIL compensation that flows through a school, such as compensation being provided through the House settlement, is subject to Title IX. But President Trump rescinded that fact sheet and has taken the opposite approach, that NIL revenue sharing is not within the scope of Title IX. And the matter will ultimately be resolved by the courts, including potentially in this appeal of the House settlement. But there was also, even prior to the settlement, a case pending against the University of Oregon with multifaceted claims attacking all sorts of allegedly discriminatory financial aid between men and women, but also specifically that the male athletes on campus were getting superior NIL opportunities and publicity, and that was a form of Title IX violations. So far, in terms of what's happened in the House settlement, Judge Wilkin rejected the idea that she had a say in Title IX's application to the party's dispute. In fact, she went so far as to say Title IX does not apply to damages awards in an antitrust litigation. So as to the retrospective $2.8 billion payments, she already has held that it doesn't apply, but perhaps it would apply to the injunctive relief that authorizes future payments. One last point I want to make before we go back around the horn here is Title IX, the House settlement does not resolve the question of employee status. The settlement studiously denies conferring employee status on college athletes. If they ever attain employee status, it will require separate legal action, many of which were pending, including under petitions to unionize and unfair labor practices claims brought before the NLRB, Federal Court Fair Labor Standards Act claims brought against a number of private and public universities. A bunch of those claims were withdrawn right after at least the NLRB claims were withdrawn right after President Trump was inaugurated because there was a concern that the NLRB in the new administration would be unfriendly to these claims and would create bad precedent. But the Fair Labor Standards Act's claims proceed, and they seem to be heading towards a declaration that in certain circumstances, college athletes can be considered employees of their university. And that is not resolved at all by the House settlement. And that actually may provide the cleanest and most viable avenue for all of college athletics disputes to be resolved, because especially antitrust disputes, because if these athletes are considered employees and unionized, and we resolve a whole host of complicated procedural obstacles to this being effectuated, but unionized athletes who enter into collective bargaining agreements with their universities or other entity, that would confer antitrust immunity for whatever working conditions and whatever playing and practice conditions they ultimately agree on. I'll stop there.
Thank you so much, Professor. So if we wanted to circle back to some of the questions that have been asked or respond to anyone else, I wasn't sure if that's what you wanted to do first, Rakesh.
Yes, I mean, maybe we could do a little round robin because I think great questions were asked. On the futures piece, we'll give a little tweak to something Professor Balsam said, which is just how the future piece is going to work. The damages settlement is limited to existing student athletes. So future student athletes aren't actually releasing any damages claims. So if you enroll in college sports this fall, if you enroll 2 years from now, et cetera, you have the theoretical ability to bring a damages lawsuit based on the idea that you would have gotten paid more than you're currently getting paid in the new world that's created by the settlement. Incoming student athletes will be bound to the injunction, which is the 10-year term, which is the future-looking piece. So they'll be bound to the cap, they'll be bound to those rules and so on and so forth, but they will, as Professor Balsam said, have an opportunity to object to that. So a question was asked, you know, what about the high school freshman? What about the, you know, 6-year-old who's on the playground? The simple answer is they're not bound until they come into college sports. And once they come into college sports, they'll get their notice. And we're actually going to go through this process pretty soon for the 2025-2026 class. They'll get a piece of paper and they'll get the notice that says, here are your rights. They'll have a chance to come in to Judge Wilkin and say, here are issues we have with the settlement. You know, I know you went through this process before, but the cap isn't right, or this issue or that issue. And I think the judge will evaluate those and think carefully about them, as she's already done with the objections that are in front of her, and make a decision. So I think from a due process perspective, we've sort of given folks a right to not be bound until after they have a chance to object. And that was actually something that I think we always intended, but was a good clarification that was made after the initial final approval hearing, which then, I suppose, goes right to the question someone else asks is, well, what the heck are you doing if there's all these potential other sources of litigation out there? Why settle the case at all? And the answer is, I think I'm probably a little more sanguine than others about whether this buys some measure of peace or not. I think it is true that there's not a settlement solution that's going to solve every potential problem. So, for example, Title IX is an issue schools deal with on a year-by-year basis. And every year, schools are required to comply with Title IX and make their best efforts to comply with it. And I think that's going to continue in the future. And I think that would have continued whether we had the settlement or not. You know, there's a Title IX obligation for athletic aid of any form, whether it's the pool structure through the settlement or whether it's something else. The bigger question, I suppose, is just, have we actually bought ourselves any form of antitrust peace or not? And I guess, obviously, I have an interest in this, but I think the answer is yes, relative to other status quos. If you continue to litigate these cases, I think we would have found ourselves in the pattern we've been in for the last decade, and if not more, which is you litigate a lawsuit to judgment, maybe some kind of incremental relief is ordered, and then you litigate another lawsuit right after that says, hey, I want more. And not wrong student athletes to bring those claims, but it's not really a recipe to bring any kind of stability. So I think instead of that antitrust lawsuit by student after antitrust lawsuit by after antitrust lawsuit by student, I think we have this structure that largely channels those lawsuits into a particular forum, channels them into a structure that will hopefully work. I mean, I am actually somewhat confident that this system will work and will be a better system than systems we've had before. I think a notable feature of it is if you add up the revenues that are already being shared between athletic departments and schools through scholarships, through existing benefits, and you add on top the 22% to 20% the revenue sharing, you get to essentially 51% revenue sharing of athletically related revenues with students. And that's basically what every pro league has settled on after collective bargaining, which is through a pretty similar process, which is to say you look at all the potential revenues, you agree on a source, a set of revenues you're going to use as a negotiating set. Some stuff gets excluded, and then they debate what percentage should go to whom. So anyway, there's a lot of reasons why I think the structure is more stable than the structure we had before. There's a lot of reasons why I think even if folks do come in the future and object, those objections may not ultimately carry the day. In fact, I'm sort of skeptical that they will, because we have this 51% structure that's going to keep increasing over time, not fixed. The numbers will go up year over year, and then there'll be opportunities to escalate in between that. So we'll see. There definitely are other sources of litigation out there. I wouldn't deny that. But I think the question is, how does this compare to where we were before? And I think from the perspective of all the parties involved, we think it's at least a pretty significant measure of progress over that.
Now, I would just add that in terms of the ongoing antitrust risk, so the settlement covers only the issues raised by the cases, and there are a host of other NCAA rules addressing things other than, for example, NIL opportunities and sharing in the revenues generated by university athletic programs, and that includes NCAA eligibility rules. And specifically, there's an NCAA eligibility rule now the subject of, I think, 23 different lawsuits. The four seasons in 5 years rule that allows an athlete to participate in NCAA athletics for four seasons that occur other than the COVID exception, which we're now past, that occur over no more than 5 years. 26 different athletes so far, I've been keeping count, and in 23 separate lawsuits have argued that that rule is an antitrust violation, partly because it deprives them of NIL opportunities. About half of those lawsuits are pending. They've had results all over the board, including some courts issuing injunctions against enforcement of that eligibility rule and imposing on the NCAA an obligation for it and its schools to permit a particular athlete to continue to compete beyond four seasons out of 5 years. But most recently, and I think Rakesh probably is familiar with this suit, the Ziegler lawsuit in, I think it was Tennessee, the court ruled against an injunction issued a pretty comprehensive opinion that said, look, the NCAA is not entitled to antitrust immunity here. The NCAA was arguing that eligibility rules such as four seasons and 5 years are not even subject to antitrust law, that they have no economic consequence. But they alternatively argued, and the argument adopted by the court was that the NCAA in establishing these rules was favorably distinguishing college sports from other types of professional, semi-professional, minor league sports, and that if you compel them to water down their product with perpetual students, it would hurt their revenues and correspondingly hurt athletes. The court made a couple of interesting points about how exclusion of this particular athlete, because they would not allow him to play for a sixth year, was not meaningful from an antitrust perspective. It was just allowing one athlete to replace another. And that the case essentially raised issues of policy, not law, that the antitrust framework was inadequate to address at least at the injunctive stage. The case proceeds now to discovery and potentially trial, but there's probably very little incentive for the athlete to continue to litigate if they are being told when you return to school in the fall, you will not be allowed to play. And you have to litigate this until a judgment otherwise. So you have all these lawsuits that remain, a threat, an antitrust threat. And I'm not sure where the true finality will emerge from, because every potential eligibility rule is subject to antitrust scrutiny, at least under Alston, which says that, you know, if a rule has economic consequences, it's subject to the rule of reason.
Thank you, Professor. Any response from you, Eric, before we turn to some of the questions in the queue? You're on mute.
Sorry, just briefly, I think that's, I agree with that assessment. At least in my view is, we start with an amateur model that, at least for all intents and purposes, no longer exists. And how do you navigate that versus ensuring fair competition and stuff like that on the field, given the fact that probably make an argument that a lot of things have economic consequences. The one thing that I would just add, I'm a sports fan. I'm an Ohio State fan. Thank you very much. So I should also add that Ohio State is a client of the Attorney General of Ohio. So we find ourselves on both sides of these issues. But another choice that I don't see my alma mater making, but other schools may make, is to not participate in this market, right? This is college sports, and college sports can make a lot of money for a lot of people, including for research arms of big schools that help, cure diseases and perhaps, if managed well, support smaller sports, Olympic type sports, right? There could be a model where this revenue is all for the good, for everyone involved, but there's another option out there, which is to simply not engage in the level of sports competition on campus that would implicate all of this, and instead focus on things besides athletics, which might be a Captain Obvious statement, but I feel like, especially as a sports fan, sometimes I forget that we could in fact just choose not to be sports fans and not engage in some of these controversies.
I think it's important to remind folks that the NCAA has 1,100 member schools. And when we're talking about the schools that will participate in the House settlement, we're talking about, 100 schools maybe? Right? There are 1,000 other NCAA schools, Division III, Division II, and even Division I schools that will not participate, that might move in the direction that Eric suggested of returning college athletics to more of an actual extracurricular activity and focus their institutional mission on education, maybe.
I think both of you raised great points, which is somewhat responsive to some of the questions as well. There are going to be these other challenges that inevitably come about as a result of the shift in the model, as Eric mentioned. And I think these eligibility challenges are just the first of potentially many, where students are, the argument has been, well, now that there's commercial activity involved in college sports, now that NIL is involved, eligibility rules are a restriction on my ability to participate in commerce. We have fortunately won 16 of the 19 of those cases that have been filed. The other three are on appeal, and we'll see what happens in those. I think the challenge that exists out there in the law has always been that it's not clear that antitrust is by any means the best way to solve these problems. In fact, I'm of the view that it's quite clear that it's not the best way to solve these problems, because it's something of a blunt instrument. And I think what everyone probably realizes to some degree is that college sports are unique, and that they are sports. They're played on a college campus. There's a tie to colleges. That's what makes them great. I, like Eric, actually happen to be an Ohio State fan. And so part of what I love about college sports is the tie between the players and the university. there is also this commercial aspect of college sports that's gotten undeniably bigger over the last few decades. So the question of how do you balance those two things? How do you acknowledge that there needs to be or should be, I think, some tie to the college atmosphere to preserve what makes these sports popular for so many and frankly what makes them attractive for many of the participants, which is that the opportunity to play in this sport for a limited period of time and move on, with these commercial aspects like folks saying, well, this could be the best it gets for me, so I want to play for 6, 7, 8 years. And the courts are trying to make sense of these decisions. And I think the courts addressing the eligibility rules by and large have, which is to say, there still is something college related about college sports. And it may simply be that you're enrolled in college and you have a limited time to play because that's how long one's expected to be in college. But in a lot of ways, that's the defining feature of college sports. But really the only way, and I think the NCAA has been consistent on this, to really get true stability in this context is for there to be some kind of congressional action to really stabilize this area of the law. I think the settlement is a first step. I don't think it's a 100% step, as others have flagged. I do think it's an important step forward. But there's been a lot of discussion about whether there could be or will be some kind of bill from Congress. And I think the ask from the NCAA's perspective is pretty much to let the system under the settlement work, which is to say, to not have antitrust liability essentially for complying with the settlement, to say that complying with the settlement is sort of a good step and an appropriate step. It is to try to recognize that, at least from many of our perspectives, the employment model does not really work cohesively across a college campus for purposes of college sports. And so perhaps to carve out college sports from employment status for those purposes, because there are these other lawsuits out there. And then there's a piece about state law preemption, which is to the extent states are passing laws that are inconsistent with or kind of trying to drive particular competitive advantage outcomes for their state, that you preempt those laws to that limited effect. Now, those features are controversial. I suspect that both of my panelists will have strong adverse reactions to some aspects of that. And so we'll see what actually happens in terms of whether that bill gets passed. But I think at the end of the day, the settlement is a good and important step forward, but it's not the only step if we want to have some kind of true stability and actually have a kind of semi-permanent state for college sports, as opposed to there being a bunch of other challenges that come out. I do think there's fewer challenges today than yesterday, but how many fewer remains to be seen.
Now, I would just note that there's an interesting distinction that European competition law makes that's not available under the current reading of the Sherman Act and our antitrust doctrine, which is European competition law does allow for the consideration of weighing of social good and non-economic goals, an argument that the NCAA made for decades, ultimately unsuccessfully, leading up to the Alston decision and beyond. But that's sort of what this proposed legislation is attempting to do, is attempting to, through a policy decision, which is, of course, the appropriate role of legislative decision making, say that there's a social good here in insulating the NCAA's eligibility rules from antitrust attack, in protecting college athlete status as amateurs and not as employees. But I just think it's interesting to note that in European competition law, they rely on the courts and other tribunals to sort through these issues because they actually allow affirmative consideration of the social good and non-economic goals, and have done so specifically in the sporting environment. But because the U.S. approach to antitrust does not permit that consideration, this is a bottomless pit of antitrust vulnerability without either a legislative solution or, as I mentioned earlier, the non-statutory labor exemption that would apply and immunizing relationships between universities and their athletes if they were to unionize, attain employee status, unionize, and enter into collective bargaining agreements. And I read recently an interesting approach to how this could be done to avoid the problem that most of these athletes, if they were to attain employee status, would be state employees, employees of state public universities who are not subject to federal labor law. This is why when you see petitions to the NLRB or other attempts to apply labor law to the university setting, it's brought almost exclusively in the context of private universities who are subject to federal labor law. So what do you do about the fact that if you all of a sudden, you know, waved a magic wand and all D1 athletes were employees, how do you resolve the fact that we have 50 states whose state public employee labor law is different from each other, right? How do you reconcile those differences? One way to do it, which not my idea, but it's one I recently read about and liked, is perhaps the college athletes could be employees of their conferences. The conferences are private entities which enter into the TV deals on behalf of the conference. This obviously applies only to schools who participate in conference TV deals, not to say the rare occasion like a Notre Dame, who is an independent actor in this economic activity. But if the conferences were to employ all of the athletes within their conference, they would all be subject to federal labor law, and you might have some overlapping collective bargaining agreements, but you would achieve antitrust immunity, and you can set whatever restraints on the labor market that a professional league sets, right? You could have limitations on the number of years you could play. You could have limitations on transferring, on free agency. All of that would be immune from antitrust attack if it were agreed upon in the context of collective bargaining.
Thank you, Professor. So we have, about 13 minutes left. So I think we should look at some of the questions that we have from our audience. It looks like we've addressed the first one. Looking specifically to the opt-in rate, what do all of you think may be some of the pros and cons that the colleges themselves may be considering, whether or not to opt in? And then combining this with another question, do we envision Ivy League schools to opt in, and historically Black colleges? How may this opting in and opting out impact those types of schools with, different priorities and funding?
Maybe I'll start on that. I'll be very interested to see what decisions schools make over the course of the next few weeks. So I believe the opt-in deadline is now June 30th, and some schools have made some confidential expressions of interest in opting in, but I think the final decisions are going to be made a couple weeks from now. And I don't think that there's a clear right answer to this. So it's not like some school should obviously do X and some school should obviously do Y. I mean, start with the easy ones, the sort of autonomy five conferences. They're bound by the settlement, so they're in. So you have 69 right now schools who are going to be part of this new structure. It's their revenues by and large that set the pool for everyone. I think other schools and conferences will have to make some interesting choices. And the first choice is, as others have said, whether to try to participate in this new world or not. One option is to not opt into the settlement and continue to operate under largely the old rules, with the exception of scholarship limits not being in effect anymore. Another option is to participate in the new structure and adhere to roster limits and so on, but only focus kind of additional financial incentives or abilities on certain particular sports. I do think it gives opportunities for more schools to potentially compete. So HBCUs are one example. I actually think have done pretty well in the kind of new NIL era of late in terms of being able to field pretty competitive teams with pretty competitive players. So I think schools are going to make a lot of individualized choices is really the bottom line. I think the settlement structure allows them to compete in this new pool structure if they want to. It allows them to prioritize certain sports over others if they want to. It also allows them to adopt a model that allows more folks to have the ability to compete in college sports and focus on a broad base of offerings spread across a broad group of students instead of focusing exclusively on one sport or a few sports. So I think it's a little too early to tell exactly how that's going to play out, and maybe very interested to see how it does play out. And then, of course, the decisions that schools make as to whether to opt in or not may have some consequences on what they need to do from a Title IX perspective going forward.
And just from a state regulator perspective, in the theoretical world where this actually will matter, there's a really interesting question, which is, what if the restrictions in the settlement that you want to opt into are contrary to state law? For instance, state law says you can't have a cap on NIL money, and the settlement does. And again, back to my first point, the states aren't parties to this settlement and, you know, theoretically could say, wait a minute, you know, this actually violates state antitrust law. In fact, I saw at least the DOJ kind of saying the same thing. Well, we'll see when we get there what we think about all this. But, you know, it's a settlement of an antitrust matter between private parties. I think the answer to that, as Rakesh was saying, I think Professor Balsam as well, legislation, right? I mean, I think there's value for everyone in resolving the matter on, I think, an unavoidably national level to some degree, even if there's some room for regional or state differences. Because again, even as regulators, we don't want a potentially positive resolution, partially solving some issues, to be thwarted by everybody's own regulatory ego, I guess. But it's interesting, right? I mean, you're talking specifically about an agreement that theoretically, you know, looks, or I wouldn't say ignores, but, you know, could run contrary to laws. And what do we do about that? We've dealt with that in other contexts with, and, you know, again, I think generally speaking, regulators are going to want to try to support a resolution if they can. And I think that calls for some congressional action to help kind of settle all of these things as a nation. And I was going to say something else, but I forgot. So I'll stop there.
Rakesh, going back to your previous point about how the opting in may allow for, you know, different schools more opportunities to compete, was there any discussion about schools that may be opting in, whether or not that could actually revive very successful athletic programs or specific sports that for maybe Title IX reasons or for funding reasons may be able to be brought back, you know, looking specifically at like ski teams, equestrian teams, and most notably, I would say like men's soccer programs.
I think it's definitely a possibility. One of the comments asked a question, which I think is a fair one, about is this settlement just going to lead to the demise of so-called non-revenue sports, and particularly on the men's side where you don't have the Title IX balancing effect. I think we'll see on that one. I am hopeful that that won't be something that occurs by and large as a result of this settlement. Yes, there is additional revenue sharing that's permitted by the settlement for certain sports. I think there's a real question about how many schools can expect to realistically compete at the highest levels of football, at least year over year, which is traditionally the biggest revenue driver. And also there are a lot of schools that take pride in, I think some comments were made about this as well, take pride in having a broad base of athletic competitions, a broad base of athletic opportunities, competing for what used to be called the Director's Cup, and it may be called something else now, which is the cup for, you know, having as many different college sports championships as you can. So we'll see. I think one of the things I will note though is there's been a lot like a consensus for a while now that antitrust was the right way to target this social problem, which is how to correctly balance equities in college sports. One of the things that happens when antitrust lawsuits are filed is that you move to market outcomes, where market participants can make what they think are economically rational decisions for them. And those are not always, to Professor Balsam's point, social good answers. Those are sometimes pure economic answers. And so to the extent that in a quote unquote less restrained marketplace with a cap, you see some schools going all in on certain sports, that's a little bit of consequence of going the antitrust route and trying to solve this issue. Now, I happen to think that some of the other routes, like employment, have their own hornet's nets of problems that do not work across most college campuses and raise a host of questions, such as who's negotiating? Is it one sport? Is it all sports? Is it all students at a school? Is it all student athletes at a school? Is it all student athletes at a conference? Are there individual negotiations for football versus basketball versus other sports? I mean, there's just a lot of complicated questions that come up if you try to move to an employment model before you even get into the issues of how it intersects with different state laws within an athletic conference. But that's just to say that there, to the extent there are some more kind of market-based outcomes in an antitrust context, that's sort of a consequence of the move towards applying antitrust laws to sports leagues.
That makes sense. Any responses from Professor Balsam or Eric to that?
I would like to see two different unions, one for offense and defense, but also, you know, I mean, just to like play the devil's advocate again, I've got 14 state universities as clients of the AGO plus an antitrust enforcement act. So I can play both sides all day. But, you know, as I'm thinking about it, as we were going through our case, antitrust became applicable because there became a huge market for which you make money and, you know, don't have to pay labor. You know what I mean? Like, which came first, the market or the idea that to, you know, apply antitrust to the situation? But that's only my elite athlete view of retort to Rakesh's position.
I would just respond to one question I saw in the queue about how would a conference as employer model actually work? And I see it working along the lines of how current professional sports leagues collective bargaining works, right? So a professional sports league is comprised of 30 some odd teams that are separate economic entities, the way that the various athletic conferences are separate economic entities. They would collectively negotiate as a multi-employer bargaining unit vis-a-vis each of the different sports. I would imagine that the union contracts would be sort of sport by sport. And universities within each conference obviously would have to vote to opt in to have their conference employ their students. But there's no reason why those students couldn't be employed by the conference and yet play ball for a particular university within that conference and be enrolled in a particular program and be committed to that program for whatever number of years that the conference negotiates for non-free agent status with the players' union. Right. Almost every professional sports league in the United States has some form of non-mobility in the early years of their playing career. It's rare that you have free agency from day one, except for, I think now, the National Women's Soccer League. First one to have free agency from day one. But you have, you know, rookie drafts and you have mandatory salary scales. And so there would probably be some sort of compulsory stability in the first couple of years and maybe then an opportunity to transfer. But that would all have to be negotiated. And whatever's negotiated is fine, right? It's what the parties deem in their self-interest to keep the games moving forward. And it would all be immune from antitrust.
The last question we have, I believe, goes to you, Eric. Who was worse? Okay, I will leave this to the two of you. Who was worse, Michigan State or Penn State to the Ohio State?
Such a good question. I mean, we need to extend this to at least 30 minutes. The answer is, wait, who's worse?
Who do you hate more, Michigan, Penn State, or Michigan State?
The answer is Michigan.
This isn't a hard one, right, Eric?
It's not a hard one.
Yeah, no, it's not hard. The answer is Michigan. And You know, this I will take a strong position on. I play both sides. I work for a politician, but there's just a clear answer to this question, and that's Michigan. So in conclusion, it's Michigan. Okay. Do you need any rebuttal? Any rebuttal?
I'm not a big
glad that
I'm staying out of this.
I'm glad that every antitrust expert and me too agrees on this particular issue.
Well, thank you all so much, Eric, Rakesh, and Professor, and I will turn it back over to Edith.
Yes, and just to echo that, on behalf of the Federalist Society, thank you so much to Professor Balsam, Eric, and Rakesh for speaking with us today, and to Caitlin for moderating. We're so grateful for your time and expertise. And thank you also to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your participation. You can stay up to date with announcements and other upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org, or on all major social media platforms. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.